and welcome to episode 15 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I am Nate Mavis, and with me today is Gareth Chandler. How are you, Gareth?
I'm great. Can't complain about anything.
And where are you coming to us from?
I'm in Lima, Peru right now, but I'm actually going to be here only a few more days. Then I'm going to go to Santiago, Chile for the first time, which should be entertaining, to say the least.
Excellent. Very good. We should tell our listeners that we don't have Andrew this week because Andrew is at the PCA at Atlantis in the Bahamas. And if you have ever been to the PCA or if you have ever read the Twitter feed of somebody who is at the PCA, you know that the internet connection there is terrible and certainly not good enough to support a Skype call. So we have no Andrew this week, but Gareth was kind enough to join us. And so how's Peru treating you?
It's been kind of wild, actually. I had planned on coming here to not have an adventurous time, and I had planned on staying about 4 months. And I've been here 5 weeks, and I'm now exercising an exit strategy. So,
is the wildness of your stay related to the fact that you're leaving early?
Yes, yes.
Anything you care to share with the whole world?
It's true. Well, it's going to be, it is going to be made relatively public in the next PokerStars blog piece in a month or so. So I guess I can spoil a little bit. It's directly correlated to my decision to move in with a crazy Peruvian woman about 3 weeks ago or so. And the fact that her uncle, Fernando, knows me and I fear him. So that's, that's basically those are the main components of the story. Yeah.
Okay. So, well, it's really nice of you to join us while you're on the run from Fernando, possibly.
Fernando's a really nice guy. Really nice guy, actually. And, I just don't trust him to take my word over hers. That's the thing. And I also did get this gig writing for the PokerStars blog. So if I was profitable enough in November and December, I was going to try and do a little 3 or 4 country loop just to get content for that job. So I did have a good November and December. So I am, it just kind of works out both ways that, you know, I have a reason to leave. I have a reason to go the places I'm going and I have a reason to leave the place I'm in.
So, very, very good. Yeah. So you've had a good November and December. Those of us who follow you online have seen you posting hands from Zoom. So has this been exclusively playing on PokerStars, or have you been playing in live card rooms also?
No, I haven't played too much since. I guess I played in Cartagena and Bogota at the end of November and start of December. But really for the past 4 weeks, while I was just trying to budget my time to make Supernova, I haven't gotten that much. I haven't gotten any appreciable volume, but that should all change moving forward, because most of the part of the gig writing these blog entries for the PokerStars blog requires me to have something entertaining happen in live card rooms.
I
so
see.
I was a bit worried, actually, which in hindsight seems very silly. I got the gig before I left, and then, you know, I hadn't, like I said, I was just planning on vacationing in Colombia and then grinding Supernova in Peru. And it's not, people don't want to read about me going to a cafe and, you know, six tabling for hours on end. So I was worried I wouldn't have anything to write about, but that has proved not to be the case.
So thankfully your way of life keeps things interesting enough. Possibly Fernando's way of life will also keep things interesting enough.
Yeah.
Good. So we've got some hands from Gareth that we're going to talk about. We have an email from a listener that we're going to discuss. Before we do that, we should probably let Gareth plug those blog articles again, just so those of you who want to read about Gareth's travels can do that.
The title of the column is Borderline Gambling, which I think is pretty well named. The first two are out already on the PokerStars blog. The first one is about Cartagena and some of my decision to take a shot at a 5-10 game there, and actually losing my luggage as well. And then the second one is out as well on Bogota, and it's more, I guess there's less danger involved. I play 1-2, and I also just get to tour Bogota, which is a really big city. And then the third one is not going to be out until the end of January, I think. And it details actually me playing in the LAPT Lima, Peru event about a year ago, maybe even more than a year ago now. And then, yeah, also my most recent adventures in Lima, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, if you guys want to go to it, I don't have a contract to keep writing them, but I would love to keep being able to write one. So if you provide the hit, you know, that would be, that'd be good for me.
All right. So we'll put it in the show notes. People can read it if they want to, and I'm sure they do want to. We'll get it a lot of traffic, and PokerStars can give you some more money to write some more. Then you can keep on traveling around the world, and everybody wins, I think. Pretty sure there are no losers in that scenario, except possibly regulars in card rooms in South America. They probably lose when you come around, but other than that, everybody wins. Okay, very good. So we do have an email.
Well, one would hope.
Yes. Our email today comes from a guy who signs his emails Skinny Brown, and he wants to ask us about a hand. So this is in a live card room. The villain is a recreational Asian player in his early 30s. Skinny Brown says he's aware that I'm a regular and knows that I'm a good player. Hero is 27 years old. He describes himself as a very good-looking, half-Mexican, half-Swedish accountant with a heart of gold. The villain does not know about my ethnicity, profession, or how golden my heart is. You know the joke is good when I actually leave it in on the air. So effective stacks are $500. Skinny Brown limps ace five of spades under the gun plus one. Two other players limp in the field. The villain makes it $20 in the cutoff. The button calls, small blind calls, hero calls, and one of the limpers also calls. So we've got five to the flop for $20 each. And I think the first question I want to ask and I want to think about is, what does it mean when somebody who's a guy in a live card room, early 30s, makes it $20 over three limpers in a 2-5 game? So that's a big underraise. And I think in my experience, it often means a hand like ace-jack or king-queen or king-jack suited or something like that, where he feels obligated to raise. I often think if a guy has a hand like queens or jacks, he's going to make it $30 or $40 or $50 there. I think to me, it usually indicates that he feels like raising with the hand, but is not thinking too much about shutting out the field or about what the right raise size is. It's just sort of a hand that goes in the raising category, but he's not too excited about. So my first instinct is a Broadway hand or maybe a medium pair or a hand like that. What do you think, Gareth?
Yeah, I think those thoughts line up pretty well with mine. I would say that you said the phrase, it's a hand that he feels like raising. So I think it can include junkier hands as well, because he's in the cutoff and he just sees these people limp. I think live players in the cutoff with limpers in front of them are capable of a fairly random assortment of things. So sure. Sometimes I think this could just be the 9-7 of clubs and he just feels like raising. But I also agree, the more important point is that his small sizing caps his range significantly.
Yes.
He would either consider it more with a top, say, 4% hand, or top 3% hand, being jacks plus ace king, he would consider it more. And if he didn't consider it, then he would have an auto size of much larger than this. So either way, caps his range.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I've been surprised before. I have seen people turn over aces or kings in a spot like this, but I think it's rare, and I do think we can really discount the top end of his range. I also think that you're right that he could have some junkier hands, and I think if the feels like raising psychological read is correct, then I would want to confirm it with some physical evidence. So if it looked like he wasn't thinking about it too much, if it looked like he was just grabbing some chips and throwing them in, then I would be even more confident in this read that he looked at his hand, wanted to play it for $20, and threw $20 in the pot. Yeah. This is the sort of read that you can confirm with physical information, even against a player who's not a huge tell box. And it's also the sort of case where negative information can really help you too. Like if you didn't notice him think for a long time or get nervous or look like he really had a decision, then I think that would also confirm the read.
What do you think about Skinny Brown's preflop decision to open limp? I know you probably don't want to talk about that too long, but I feel like it's quite marginal.
Yeah, I do think it's marginal. I think that if it's a game that's pretty passive, and if it's a game where people are consistently under-raising before the flop, then I don't mind it. My standard play here would be to fold. But I do think that if you have bad playing passive, and especially passive preflop, that's really important. If you have preflop passivity and weakness in your opponents, then you have a suited ace, and sure, it's worth $5. But my standard is to fold, and it sounds like you agree with that.
Yeah, I think we should have, I guess, a limping range in this situation, in this spot, preflop. But the width of that limping range really is a function of stack depths as well as the passivity of the people playing. And if we only have $500 effective, so 100 big blinds, then I think that really constrains a lot of the good things that can happen with a nut drawing hand like this. So
yes,
yeah, if it was like 1200 effective with like six of the nine players at the table, I would say it's a no-brainer limp. But since that's not true, I'm not too sure.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure it's an automatic limp if you're deep with those players, just because if they play well after the flop, then the fact that you're out of position and you are deep will trump the fact that you have a nut draw, I think, or that you can make a nut draw X percent of the time, because after all, that X is not very large.
Right.
So, I mean, if you have typical 2-5 opponents, then yes, I'm really happy to play suited ace for $5. Yeah. But even players who aren't great can sometimes be the right kind of aggressive, where you still don't want to be out of position $1,200 deep. So really, you want to be thinking more about how your opponents play than in the first instance just categorizing them as good or bad.
Yeah, so we need both those ingredients. We need that passivity ingredient as well, like you said off the top.
Yes, that's right. And especially the preflop passivity, just to keep the effective stack deep. So, right, don't like the limp. Once it goes limp, raise, button call, small blind call, then I guess it's still marginal. I think this decision is maybe a slight mistake, the way the preflop, the first decision preflop, is a slight mistake. Would you rather fold or call when it gets back to you for $15 more? I think I'd be inclined to call once I had the first five in. What do you think?
I feel like we're obliged. I mean, if Hero thought that the limp was plus EV, given the table conditions, then this scenario unfolding seems like it would be in the set of scenarios he thought was profitable to continue. Yeah, so I think they both might be a mistake, but this seems like, yeah, something that he's probably counting on being profitable if he's limping in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I think it does. And I think at the end of the day, there are four people already in for $20, two more limpers who are probably going to call, and, you know, it's only $15 more to him. So how bad can it be?
Yeah, the people behind aren't going to raise ever, so.
Oh, sometimes they will, but less than 5% of the time, so.
Right.
But I guess I'm wrong slightly about that, because only one and not both of the limpers call. So they're five-handed, going to the flop. Ace of clubs, four of diamonds, ten of clubs. Again, the hero has ace-five of spades, and the flop is ace-ten-four with the ace-ten suited in, of course, a different suit. $108 in the pot, and the flop checks through. I don't see much reason to lead out here, do you?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, I think it'll turn your hand face up to people. Whether or not that's what they should think you have, I think that's they'll put you on a medium ace or an ace generally, and I think they'll play pretty well against you, whatever their read is, and I don't like a bet. So I like the check. And I like that Skinny Brown here noticed that Villain checked his hand quickly with not much thought at all. So it's a good observation. We go to the turn. Ace 4-10, and the turn is a 6, and it does not complete the flush. Still $108 in the pot, and it checks to Skinny Brown, who bets 60 into 108. How do you like the bet size, and how do you like the bet?
I like the bet size more or less. I think one could argue for 75, but I'm not sure about bigger bet sizes than that. I guess I could be talked into something bigger as well. I think betting makes a lot of sense, even if the four people have on average 2.5 outs. Once you add them up, we have a pretty clear incentive to not allow the field to free roll us on the turn.
Yes.
And we have a big incentive just to end the hand here, actually. Like, a good outcome for us is taking down the pot. So, I don't know. A lot of players who play these stakes, like, at least those that I coach, get upset when they bet and win. And I say, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, winning the pot isn't, I mean, you win the pot. Like, it's not so bad.
Yeah, I mean, especially given that before the flop, at least I was thinking, crap, we got into a raised pot with this hand. Like, if you told me hypothetically before the flop that we could win a $108 pot uncontested by flopping top right. pair, like, I'd be pretty happy about that. Which maybe is right. a reason not to play the hand in the first place, right? But winning the pot, great result.
And then having only one villain call also isn't the worst outcome either. So getting raised, I mean, I know what I would do. I would fold, but getting raised from someone in the field, that is, and then getting called by the initial raiser, that's a good outcome as well. So I think betting makes a lot of sense here, especially when we judge it against the alternative of it potentially checking through or even facing a bet. Like, neither of those two things seem to me to be great scenarios for our hand given our position.
Yeah, I think that's right. One thing I like about this bet size is that it's big enough to fold out a lot of hands and either win you the pot or get it heads up. But it might also be small enough to induce a mistaken call from a hand like Jack 10 or even a Broadway gut shot or a gut shot like 7-8, 8-9, 7-9.
Yes.
And remember that before the flop, again, this important poker skill here is like combining your reads, right? Before the flop, we thought that a lot of Broadway hands would be possible. When he checks the flop, of course, he could be pot controlling or just scared with an ace, but he could also have a Broadway gut shot, right? And he could make a mistake with that hand on the turn and peel it off for $60. And we want to let him do that with King Jack, Queen 10, 7-6 for a pair of sixes, or 7-9 for a gut shot, or a hand like that. I would say he probably doesn't have a club draw because he probably would have bet that on the flop, I think. So I do think there are some good things about this $60 bet size. Like Gareth, I can also see an argument for a bigger bet, which is just that you get slightly more honest information. maybe somebody who would have raised you just calls and then gives you a, then you can see the river when you might otherwise not have against a better hand, which is good in some ways. I mean, there are some reasons to make a bigger bet size, but I do like this $60 bet. So we go to the river, and the river is the four of hearts. So the board is ace, four, ten, six, four. The flush draw missed. Hero has ace five. And the hero decides to get a little bit fancy. He bets $20 into 228. The villain raises to $100. And then the hero moves all in for $400. Now, this is a fancy play, and I ought to read the hero's justification here. Mm-hmm. Against this range, I thought betting small to induce this player was the most optimal. At the river, I think his range is primarily pairs worse than an ace, sometimes a 10, sometimes mixed clubs, and sometimes a weak ace. He knows I'm aggressive, and I honestly believed he would bluff raise a lot of his worst hands for no other reason than to try to win the pot against me. Once he raised, it was an obvious call, but then I thought there was the chance that he could have an ace that is chopping the pot. His raise sizing preflop is somewhat indicative of a hand like ace-x, where x is 9 or less. I think he's always betting ace-10 and ace-4 on the flop given the board texture, so the only hand we have to worry about is specifically ace-6 suited, two combinations. Okay, there's a lot to say there. I think Gareth and I both... So just to start out with some of the facts of the case here. We can't discuss everything or else we'll talk for 3 hours. I think what we just said disagree with some of these range facts. I think Gareth and I both think that a hand like a Broadway gut shot might be a little bit more probable, that a hand like a single ace might be a little bit less probable given that he checked the flop. We both think that a hand like a 10 could happen. What do you think, Gareth?
I think that Hero is having a classic issue with judging two events that are of small probability. So the first one being that villain raises to 100 with a better hand than him. So that's an event of small probability.
Yes.
And I guess that's the main thing of small probability that strikes me. Like, to shove here, he basically has to almost always be best. And he's also somehow bluffing people off a chop, so a villain off a chop. Right. So I just think the villain has better some appreciable amount of the time. And even if that's a small amount of the time, that kind of matters because he's never calling with worse.
Yeah, I really think that's right. I like that a lot. I also think the biggest error in Skinny Brown's thought process on the river here, besides putting in $400 with a hand that could easily, maybe not easily, but easily enough be beaten, is thinking that villain would raise to 100 with a hand like ace-7. I'm just not sure about that. I mean, villain's a regular, hero's a regular, and Skinny Brown did not give us enough information to characterize a villain in this respect. But if this was an anonymous 30-something card room regular who had ace-7 here, and it was a $228 pot, and I bet 20 on the river, I would expect him to just call a lot of the time. And
is
not...
Is he a regular? In my reading, it says he's a recreational Asian player.
Yeah,
in his early 30s. So
I think that the phrase "he's aware that I'm a regular and knows that I'm a good player" indicates that they have experience together, which I think indicates that he's at least a semi-regular. So I guess whether or not he's a regular, I think actually if he's not a regular, that makes it even less likely that he would quickly raise to $100 with ace-7 on this river. So I think my verdict here is that I like the creativity. I like considering all your options. I like fighting for pots. I just don't think that shoving for 400 is a better option than calling the 100. I'm also not sure that betting $20 is a better way to induce bluff action than just checking. I think that the villain is more likely to have no pair than Skinny Brown thinks the villain is.
And I agree with that.
So I think Skinny Brown's plan here involved inducing bluff action, and some of this is just like game flow and read based. If you think that betting $20 is a better way to do that than betting $0, then more power to you, and you were there and I wouldn't, and I'll trust you on that. But I think in my spot, I would probably just check. Once he raises to 100, I think you can be beaten here, at least some of the time. I agree with Gareth about that. And a lot of his bluff-raising hands cannot even tie with an ace, so I would call and be happy about it and not put the rest of your stack at risk.
Yeah, I think we agree on most of everything. It's pretty unclear to me that if we check and he bluffs, what his frequency and size is going to be in relation to his bluff raising frequency and size. So I'm fairly agnostic on that point. I think betting 20 could be best. Checking could be best. You know, it's pretty unclear to me, and I wouldn't make a definitive statement on which is better. But it's also pretty clear to me that there's no reason Villain couldn't have turned a set of sixes and just called without, you know, by reflex.
Yes.
He could have 6-4. He could have, you know, 4-3, 4-5. Like, his range is particularly uncapped, in my opinion. And then even if that uncapped range constitutes a small portion of his total range, yeah. Because that's really that small portion of his total range is really what we're talking about when we're talking about shoving 400. And then the other thing being, like, Skinny Brown just isn't satisfied with his plan working out perfectly. Like, he bet 20, the Villain raised to 100 with what he thinks is a range he crushes. I mean, just call and win all the money. Like, you, sure. How much greedier do you need to be when your plan worked out?
I think that's right. I mean, of course, the stated reason is that he wanted to fold out a chop, but I think you've given a lot of reasons why that's unnecessarily risky. And just to clear something up for our listeners, you said before the flop that his range was capped, and then just now you said that his range was not capped. And just to be totally clear, what you mean is that the strongest pre-flop hands were either heavily discounted or not in his range pre-flop. But now that the board is ace 10, 4, 6, 4, he has a lot of strong hands for that board that are not necessarily top 3% hands pre-flop. So his range is uncapped relative to this board on the river. So,
yep, that's a good distinction to make.
So I think the other option on this river is, again, read your own hand. What does your hand look like? I think Villain could easily think that you have a draw. Again, there was a flush draw on the flop. There's a straight draw possible on the turn, and there's an open-end straight draw with 3-5 and 5-7. There are a lot of gut shots possible, both Broadway gut shots and gut shots between the 10 and the 6. He could think that you're just taking a shot. So there are a lot of bluffs in Hero's range here. And if he thinks that Villain has showdown value often, which it looks like Skinny Brown does think Villain has that, why not bet like $195 into 228 and let him put you on a bluff and call?
Yeah, that's definitely a option worth exploring. I might go with 150.
Sure.
Just because I think 195 or something like that is going to appear like disproportionately large to this player. We notice if he did have a bluff and made it 100, like, to him that is a bluff size, and he doesn't perceive that as particularly small,
yeah,
in relation to the pot, even though it is.
Yeah.
So I think 150, I would be worried that he would just be folding too often versus 195.
Yeah, yeah, especially if we want calls from Jack 10, 7-6, even King Queen, then yeah. So I think actually that might be my default play on this river. One merit of a bet like 150 is that, I mean, I would be primarily betting that as a bluff catcher to try to get a call from Jack 10, but also some small percentage of the time he's going to fold ace jack to that bet, and that's very good for you.
this is a reoccurring theme of yours in the podcast, it seems to me, where you want to have it both ways. I don't I don't know. I don't really follow your reasoning in the, I like betting. Betting inherently creates profit in no limit hold'em. That's true, but I think we want to target a certain range. We're playing in a game where pretty much every action we take should be deviation from GTO. We should be very exploitable,
Yes.
and I don't see why we. I don't know. You've mentioned this a few episodes that you want to have it both ways, and I don't follow at all, to be honest. That might be
Yeah.
a deficit in my thinking, but.
Well, what I mean in the first case is just that strictly it's possible for him to fold or to call with a lot of worse hands and to fold better hands. And I don't make this play mostly expecting him to fold out better hands. I don't mostly make it as a bluff, but I think it's just a basic healthy habit of thought. Like, we make all these assumptions about a player. He's recreational. He's probably not looking to fold a lot of pairs. He's probably not looking to fold a lot of top pairs. Probably his range was capped before the flop. Probably he wouldn't have checked behind ace 10, and that's fine. We make all these guesses. But then when you're analyzing the overall value of a play, of course, you only have the information that you have and you only have your best guesses, but you have to think about, well, what if I'm wrong, you know? And in this case, what are the clear ways that you could be wrong? Well, first, maybe you were wrong about preflop. Maybe that $20 raise doesn't cap his range preflop as much as we thought it does. And, you know, you should account for that. And I think, in my experience, another way that my whole analysis might be wrong is that this guy might be a lot tighter than I give him credit for. You know, there's just that X percent of players who, as soon as you put out more than a stack of red, it's a big bet, and they don't want to make the quote unquote fish play of calling it with just one pair or losing too much money with ace queen because they run in super system that ace queen is not a very good hand or something like that. So it's not that I want it both ways. It's not that I bet and I say, you know, X and not X and everything will be good for me and all the money will come to me. You know, it's not, I'm not saying that, but it's just a fact that I expect that bet to be called by worse a decent amount of time, but that sometimes everything that I've been thinking has been somewhat mistaken. And not because I've made mistakes, just because you just make a trade-off between thoughts that you're capable of thinking, given the computational limits of a human brain, and completely accurate thoughts, and what are the ways that I could have been inaccurate. So,
No, that all makes sense to me. I guess, and the other, the thing I guess that threw me off is that betting does create profit. Like it's very hard to not make money when you're the aggressor in
yes.
no limit hold'em. And I'm all for epistemological humility. I'm all for that. I guess your explanation makes sense. Certainly, if he can fold ace jack because he perceived five-way flop to be a reason for trepidation. Certainly, there's a small portion of live players who see the value in constricting their putting in a lot of money range as a function of how many people saw the flop.
Yeah.
More often than not, they don't make that adjustment. They don't, oh, like, you know, five people saw the flop. I should play the same.
Yeah, exactly.
My hand strength is, you know, unchanged.
It especially it one funny thing is like it matters how long the turn took, like it matters how long people were thinking and everything, because if the flop was like 2.5 minutes ago, people just completely forget that there were three other dudes in the pot. You know, like it's just like that's just like ancient history. I can't even remember the flop.
That happens in Zoom. I mean, never mind. Yeah, never mind live poker. Like I have a student who was talking about, oh, should I fold aces on this river? And I was saying, well, you know, we saw the flop four ways. And oh, did we? Like we're watching the hand in real time on video.
Right.
It's a Zoom hand, like it's very fast. So I definitely. So yeah, this guy could be the guy who perceives his hand as just a showdown hand worthy of one bet with ace jack. That's definitely true. But I just think that if we're gonna defend betting 150, we really shouldn't defend it by Yeah, saying he could fold ace jack, you know, like 1% of the time that he has ace jack really isn't a worthy footnote to the defense, I would say.
Sure. Yeah, that seems right. But at the same time, I mean, I think it can be useful to think about how these little considerations affect your play. You know, these weird little edge cases, do they generally favor one thing or another? And then if they do, it's an extra reason for it. Just to take an easy case, like it folds around to you in the small blind of a tournament, and you have 17 big blinds and ace deuce. Of course, you have to move all in there for a lot of reasons. But remember that when the other guy folds ace four, I mean, you might not think he's going to fold ace four, but if he does, that's just an EV bonanza for you. I mean, that's just champagne room awesome for you. So that's good. So thank you to Skinny Brown for sending in the hand. How about we go freshen up our drinks and then come back and we'll talk about some of Gareth's hands.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk about some of your hands, Gareth.
Sure. Yeah, it sounds great. I'll have more insight into the hero's thought process than a very good looking half Mexican, half Swedish accountant.
Yeah.
With a heart of gold.
Yeah, so good.
Okay, well, I'm playing 25 cent, 50 cent Zoom, and I have the button, and I happen to be 200 big blinds deep with the cutoff. So the cutoff raises to three times the big blind, which is standard. And I decide to three bet to nine times the big blind with queen six of spades. And this is not a hand that I would normally three bet. In fact, it's a very unusual hand, and it's a very unusual situation that I would three bet this hand. But the player in question is opening 43% in the cutoff, which is higher than what I'm led to believe is optimal. And they're also folding to 84% of three bets over a considerable sample. And I know that that is too high to be optimal. So when I see that 84% fold to bet, I want to widen my three betting range. And then when I see the stack depth, I want to widen my three betting range. So that's the reason I include a hand this week.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm a bit surprised to hear you talk about queen six suited as a hand that you would only very rarely play. I mean, I would generally be looking to fold this hand almost all the time. But I certainly think that if I'm on the button, first off, if the cutoff is stealing 43% and then folding to 84% of three bets, you know, you probably have a profitable raise with blank cards. But yep, one thing that we talked about last week and a couple of weeks ago on the podcast is that good hands to three bet are often the strongest hands that are not good enough to call. And queen six suited is not exactly the strongest hand that is not good enough to call here. But would you call this raise with queen 10 suited?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think the lack of connectivity really impairs the hand's ability to play post-flop, though,
yeah,
in some respects.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the weakest. Yeah, it's not the weakest hand. I guess I'm just making an argument that it seems clear that it should be a three bet in this spot.
Yeah, I do think that's right. And I do think that your reasoning is basically correct, that it's mostly a situational re-raise and not that for some theory reason you have this particular hand that you want to put into your three betting range. I guess I just also think you're in a good situation to re-raise. And also you've got a suited hand with a queen in it. So hooray for that. And this is far from the worst hand you could have. So I guess probably we're saying the same thing here, but I do think that
right.
I do think that there are some bonus reasons to do this with queen six. So the cutoff surprises you and calls, and then you go to the flop.
Yeah, so that's kind of concerning, but it could be the case that the cutoff actually includes some hands in their calling range that they would normally fold at a more shallow stack depth, so that the shape of their continuing range versus the three bet changes, and a hand like pocket twos is now become a call for the cutoff. That's just a short way of saying I don't know this player particularly well, and I don't know how exactly they're going to react to the three bet. But if they're full to three bet in this exact situation is actually 70% and not 85%, I'm still going to make money. So, you know, I'm not too concerned about that. But it's worth keeping in mind that he doesn't have 15% of 45% of hands exactly. You know, it could be that he has 30% of 45%.
Yeah.
And which 30% is not so clear.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's a smart thing to keep in mind. Before you make that raise, you think that he might fold 84% of the time, or in fact, maybe even more than 84% of the time. This is because he's in a situation where he's going to, I mean, it's not like he raised under the gun where he might have a stronger range. You know, he's raising out of the cutoff. So, you know, there are a lot of things to weigh here. Number one is that the 84%, although you do have a good sample for it, just for Bayesian reasons, is probably a little bit higher than his true dispositional folding to three bet number. But then you have the fact that what he raised from was the cutoff, which means that he might be folding even more. But then you have the fact that he called your raise. You know, you have that extra information is that he actually did call. So besides that giving you information about his hand, it also tells you a little bit more about his disposition to call in that spot. You know, one extra nice thing about your pre-flop re-raise is that, especially because you do have a hand with a little bit of playing value, you're so deep that he might just call and not 4-bet with a hand like Jack's, which is really nice for you. I mean, it's not a huge boon, but you would, of course, much rather see a flop in position against Jack's than fold to a 4-bet, right?
Well, I can tell you this, that, and this is more experiential, you know, take my word for it, I guess, playing these games, that he's not 4-betting queens here, and I would be surprised if he 4-bet all 16 combinations of ace-king.
Okay.
So I wouldn't be surprised if he only 4-bet, like, 4 of the 16 combinations of ace-king.
Okay.
So basically he's worried about the instance of me 5-betting when he makes that adjustment.
I see. Okay, that's interesting. And do you think that's because that's just how Zoom players at this level play, or do you think it's specifically an adjustment to the 200 big blind stacks?
Both. It's a combination of those things. Zoom players are very, very unlikely to get 200 big blinds in light at this level. They have very constricting, I guess is the best way to put it, all-in preflop ranges as the stacks escalate past 120 big blinds. And particularly against me, I would say any regular has that constricting range, both because they know, a fair number of regulars know who I am, and most of them see that my 3-bet percentage isn't that high. So they, like, at this stack depth, I'm not stacking off with kings pre, so they might not know that, but they know at least to not 4-bet queens for value here.
And I assume you agree that that means that your pre-flop raise has that extra little benefit of getting to see the flop almost always?
Yeah, for free, against jacks.
And so when you don't win the pot immediately, at least you get to see the flop with a suited queen, so, you know, bonus. Okay, so the flop comes king 8-4, and the cutoff checks, and you bet $6 into 975, and the cutoff called. Seems standard to me. Good spot for you to follow through. Good size at which to follow through. A little bit disappointing that he calls. What's going through your mind at this point?
I'm basically always going to fire a spade turn. I can't think of a spade turn that I wouldn't fire. I'm certainly giving up a fair amount in this spot, because I mean, at the time I know it's possible that is his calling or continuing versus a three bet range is wider, but I still have the read that he just folds to a ton of three bets. So kind of on the same wavelength, you and Andrew talked about, you know, if someone isn't going to continue pre-flop a lot and then they do continue, you know, you might want to hold back on c-betting, you know, some amount of the time where you ordinarily would c-bet. So while I do think, yeah, his continuing range pre could be wider than the stats indicate, I think, you know, I should keep in mind that, hey, maybe this guy seems to want to put a lot of money in, or seems content that money is going in, and I don't want to just, you know, spew off here with queen high.
Right. Right. I mean, I do think that if you have reason to think that his range is strong, and maybe this is just a play out of 2008 or 2009, but I would think that he has a lot of pocket pairs in his range because, as you said, he might think that he has a profitable set in mind with a lot of hands, and he's not going to four bet even with a hand like jacks or queens a lot of the time. And one thing I would be thinking with this hand is that a double barrel bluff would be profitable against that range. I mean, you have the problem that ace king is at least fractionally in his range, and of course other strong hands are also there, but if you think he might be timid, I would at least be considering betting more than once with this hand. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's really fair.
All right.
So I didn't bet on the turn, which is, I guess, pretty interesting in light of that agreement.
So the turn was an ace. So yeah, king, 8-4, ace. And the flop went check, bet, call, and the turn is check, and then Gareth decided to check. And, you know, I think we've outlined the reasons to bet and the reasons to check. Reason to check: cutoff looks like he likes his hand, and hero has queen high nothing. And, you know, reasons to bet: maybe the cutoff has a pocket pair that can't stand that much heat.
I think the thing I would add to that is, you know, I'm not giving up when I check this turn, and I think I can fold the weakest portions of those pocket pairs on the river. So villain, if he's thinking about it, sees that I think a lot of players at this level are going to see me turn down a very clear opportunity to bluff.
Yeah.
And then on the river, if they have, let's say, pocket nines, and I bet, they're going to very easily, maybe to their discredit, put me on like ace rag that three bet pre, and is now gone bet check bet for value on a fortuitous turn. Because a hand like ace rag both has value betting, but also is worried about getting, you know, two streets turn and river versus their turn check call river check call range. So yeah, I think the narrative of me having some ace rag when I check back the turn and then bet the river when check two is going to make sense to this level of regular in, you know, vis-a-vis the quality of his hand reading.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I would also add that isn't that also true of ace queen and ace jack? I certainly think you would three bet those at least sometimes. And although you have some reason to check behind the flop with those hands, I also think there are a lot of good reasons to bet the flop with those hands. So I think he could not only think that ace three, but also ace queen and ace jack are in your range when you go bet, check, bet on the flop, turn, and river.
I mean, it's hard for me to project their thought process in that much specificity, but I think that, yeah, I think that that could be the case. I think some players are just going to be, yeah, between them thinking that I would call ace jack or ace queen pre and them perceiving a difference in relative hand strength between ace queen and ace three on this turn, I'm not too sure that I could commit a statement like that, I guess.
I think it's something to keep in mind, but but everything you just said also makes sense. And in case our listeners were doubting your claim that you're not just going to give up on the river, we should tell them what happened on the river, which is that it came a seven. So the board was 8 King 4 Ace 7, cutoff checked. Gareth bet 1150 into 2175, so he bet half the pot. And then the cutoff raised to $35. And then Gareth shoved. Why don't you take us through the river here?
I did bet, which was sort of part of my plan in checking behind the turn. And I expected this bet to be profitable, risking 1150 to win the 20 bucks or so in the middle. And then my opponent raised to $35, and I saw that I had 90 behind. So, you know, ingredient number one is that there is actually enough money behind for there to be fold equity on a shove. So the stack depth helps me out a lot there. And I was naturally curious about why he would play any hand this way. So I looked into some of his HUD stats. I already knew his one at showdown percentage and his one money when soft flop. So those two are going to be important. But the one I actually looked up in game after he took this action was his river aggression frequency. And his river aggression frequency was 43%. So for reference for the listeners, like, this is a very high number, both theoretically, in my understanding, and, you know, in relation to other regulars at six max zoom at this level. So I thought that he could be turning a lot of hands into bluffs in this situation, given his river aggression frequency. I thought that he would bet out on the river with a lot of his value hands, given this river aggression frequency. Obviously, the fact that the board has an ace and a king on it kind of caps his range in a way, because he can't have either of those two sets. So, you know, in some sense, his range is capped given the nature of the board. He can't have 5-6 for the only straight, the only hand stronger than a set of aces is 5-6. He is very unlikely to have check-called the flop with 5-6. I have a six in my hand as a very, you know, non-zero consideration. So I thought he was just turning a lot of hands into bluffs here, like king jack, king 10. I think him betting out some of his value hands makes a lot more sense. And then I guess I should, not to talk at too much length, I should go over the fact that his one money at showdown percentage was 10 percentage points less than his one money when soft flop. And I use this a lot in game. The disparity basically points to me that he likes to win pots when he saw the flop without seeing a showdown. Often you'll see winning regulars, or, you know, break even regulars in these games with one money at showdown percentage that's much higher than their one money when soft flop percentage, and that indicates that they like to show down strong hands. So yeah, I use the disparity between the two as a guide to understand basically how people like to put in money post flop or don't like to put in money post flop. And when I took that in, you know, with his river aggression frequency and, like, in context of the board, you know, he can't have pocket kings, he can't have pocket aces, he can't have 5-6. And I think even if, like, there's even reason to rule out a set of eights and a set of fours, you know, because he had the opportunity to check raise the flop. Yeah, I just decided to stick the money in after looking at all those things.
No, that's that all sounds awesome and good things for everyone to think about. Do you... I don't mean this as a veiled or passive-aggressive criticism, but honestly, do you think that he's just likely to be bluffing, and so you're going to stick the money in and he's going to fold without doing too much hand reading? Or do you think that you can actually credibly represent a lot of really strong hands here?
Right. That's a great point. So I think, thankfully, it's a bit more of column A than of column B. Like, I think he certainly could, just the way the timing and flow of the hand happened, I actually thought he had some appreciable amount of air here. Like, you know, I wasn't trying to get him to fold like ace eight suited with this play, even though all my value hands beat ace eight.
Yes.
So that's important, actually, that his ace king is now a bluff catcher versus my line, and that it at best chops with my value range, and that he shouldn't expect me to have a bluff range when I 3-bet shove the river for 200 big blinds. Now, as to the narrative of like me having a strong hand here, I think that it at least is plausible that I could check back top set on the turn, just fearing a bonanza, to use a word favored by the podcast, a bonanza fold equity. You know, like, yeah, the ace on the turn, I now have top set, and I have three aces are out there. It's just a fold equity bonanza. So I could check that back, and I could have somehow gotten there with 5-6 or it's hard for me to say because I'd never play pocket sevens this way. I always call pre, but yeah, I guess 5-6 has some likelihood. But yeah, more of column A than column B. More of he's not going to hand read and he is going to realize, oh, I have king jack.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't expect this.
yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, after all, part of reading the situation is not only reading what your hand looks like, but also thinking about when your opponent is going to be reading your hand or not. And if he's not going to, then, you know, put the money in and let him fold, at least some fraction of the time. Can I ask for results? Did he fold?
I think there's like a function or a curve of his river time bank that like reveals what kind of hand he had. And this isn't like clear, but it's more of an art than a science, but in Zoom, you can build up really big time banks. Cause the more you play, the longer your session is, the bigger your time bank is.
Okay.
And I did not know what his time bank was in advance of making this play. But when I did make this play, his time bank was like 80 seconds. And I was like, oh no. either way, this is going to be torturous, right? So I should look at my other tables while this is going on. And I think if he was turning like King Jack into a bluff, and that's really given like the timing of the actions and the game flow, that's really what I put him on. And that's really what I'm trying to get him to fold. I'm not trying to get him to fold like ace eight that suddenly realizes, oh, I don't have a value hand. I think he would Hollywood with like King Jack for up to 30 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
Like thinking whatever. So when he went past 30 seconds in his time bank, I was really concerned that he had a strong hand and was thinking about it.
Yeah.
And he actually took the entirety of the time bank before folding. So at the very least, he exerted maximum torture.
All right. But you exerted maximum money out of him, though. So
that's, right.
I guess that's not a correct use of the verb exert, but whatever. Yeah, I like it. Nice hand.
I thought it was fun.
Yeah, I like the way you use your statistics here. That's never was something I was really good at over the table. And especially comparing the one at showdown percentage to one money, one saw flop percentage. I think that's a useful thing that I think our listeners can take to the bank pretty easily, even if they don't use it to run 200 big blind bluffs. So that's
it's a really interesting disparity to look at, because anytime you won money at the showdown, you saw the flop. So, you know, one money when saw flop, like, builds in one money at showdown in a way. But it doesn't go the other way. So when you won money at showdown, you didn't necessarily, you could, you know, when you win it on the flop, that doesn't contribute to your one money at showdown because you didn't get to see the showdown. So, because of that, I think you can really use those two stats comparatively to see, you know, if people are winning. Like, basically, there's a lot of Zoom regulars who are just trying to get to showdown at, you know, at their, you know, to their discredit, they're trying desperately to showdown their top pairs and, you know, their second pairs. And some people aren't doing that. So it's worth knowing who is trying to do that and who isn't, I think.
Yeah, that sounds good. Nice hand. Don't spend it all in one place, as we like to say. So, good. You want to talk about one more hand and then maybe talk about game selection a little bit and how you chose Zoom and meta game selection, like which things could cause you to switch your game or something like that?
Yeah, sure. I think the Pocket Sixes hand is definitely more interesting, I would say.
All right. So our last hand today is also at 25 cent, 50 cent Zoom, and Gareth is in the big blind with pocket sixes. Cutoff opens to $1.50, three times the big blind, and Gareth calls out of the big blind. And that, I think, is standard. You're not ever three betting that without a good reason, right?
Yes. I need a good reason to three bet. I think against, if I was playing like 200 NL, the best regulars, I think there's a good case for three bet or folding with an emphasis on folding. But, you know, this guy in all likelihood is not sauce 1-2-3 material. So that consideration is not in play. Calling's the only choice, I think.
Yeah, I do think that's one of the biggest leaks that people have in these games, especially people who are trying to play well have in these games, is calling a single raise with a pocket pair out of position. I think, you know, if there's one thing that people are really doing wrong, I think people just overestimate both how likely they are to win a set and how much money they're going to win when they do. I mean, is that still the case? I think it was the case in 2009. Is it still the case now?
Yeah, I mean, basically the amount you're going to win with a set is going to be a function of a lot of things, but one variable that a lot of the everyday grinders at these levels never take into account is the skill level of your opponent. So
yeah,
I don't put a lot of money in bad on the river in these games. I don't want to toot my own horn, but at 50 and L, I might be like one of the top three regulars for that skill. And that means you shouldn't set mine versus me, basically.
Right. That makes sense. Makes sense. So you call out of the big blind with sixes.
Yep.
And you hit a set, which means, you know, you're going to win his whole stack every time. Right? So that's flop comes ace of hearts, jack of hearts, six of spades, hero checks, cutoff bets 250 into 325, and you just call. And why'd you do that?
So I think a lot of people would see a very good argument for check raising here. One is that we have a value hand. That much is clear. Two is that there's a lot of money behind, and we'd like to start getting that money in.
Yes.
If the money we put in now is going to kaleidoscope on the river, by the river.
Well, and also it's pretty hard for you to represent many value hands, and it's pretty easy for you to represent a draw. So those might be other reasons to raise.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Here's the fundamental problem with check raising, in my opinion. I don't think if we get $92 in on this flop, or I guess 90 now that I called the pre-flop raise, so 180 big blinds, I don't think I'm going to be winning. And and I'm very cognizant in these now, like, for 2009 player, this may seem like bizarre, but one of the worst ways you can get money in No Limit Hold'em is set over set.
Yes.
It is the worst equity situation imaginable. So when that's true, I actually perceive there to be a very large margin of error in that, like, say you have a situation where you think it's going to be like set over set 80% of the time, and you take some route to avoid getting all the money in set over set. The 20% that you're wrong seems to me to fall into an acceptable margin of error if the 80% of the time you get it in drawing to one out. It's really important, basically, to avoid these situations.
Yes.
And the fact that you can be wrong a certain amount of the time, the leniency with which you can be wrong is a function of, like, your equity, the lowness of your equity when the bad thing happens.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just to be clear, Gareth and the villain are 180 big blinds deep in this hand. So yep. This is really affecting the play. It's a deep stack situation, as it was in the last hand. What if it was only 100 big blinds deep? Then would you check raise?
Oh, yeah. I check raise this situation all the time. Yeah.
All right. Good.
Definitely.
Good. Interesting. So it's a standard check raise, except when you're 200 big blinds deep. That all makes sense. So you check call, despite all the seeming reasons to check raise. And the turn is an offsuit deuce, ace of hearts, jack of hearts, six of spades, deuce of diamonds. And you decide to check. That seems good to me. Continues the story you were telling on the flop. Would you ever lead out here?
Against, if I had a really big sample on the player, or I knew that they would just check back ace queen here, because they like always go bet check bet, or they just don't like to play well, you know,
right,
then I would lead out. But yeah, I didn't perceive that to be the case from this player. And also, it's worth pointing out that their flop C bet is really big. They bet 250 into 325, but that 325 doesn't indicate the rake that's been taken out of the pot. So when someone bets pretty much close to the number that's showing on the PokerStars like graphic interface, I'm pretty content to check the turn, expecting a bet a large amount of the time.
Sounds good. And you get it. He bets $6 into 825, and you again decide to call.
Yep. I want to keep his value range wide, and I want to keep his bluffs in the pot. So,
any worries about giving a free card to a gut shot or a flush draw or a hand like that? You would rather not do that, but it's not as bad as inflating the pot when you don't want to and folding out bluffs and thin value hands when you don't want to.
Yeah, like I'm going to win more when he bets ace king on the river for value than it's worth me to, you know, free roll queen 10. Yeah, I mean, bad things are going to happen sometimes, but my goal is not to avoid bad things at all costs. I guess that's not the best way to put it, but no. I benefit the most from keeping his range the widest overall.
Good. So 20-25 minus rake going into the river, and it's an offsuit queen. So you have ace, jack, six, deuce, queen, and the flush draw bricks off, and Gareth checks, and the cutoff bets 14-50. That looks like value into whatever the pot was. And you decided to just call him.
Yeah. I was thinking about folding, and I kind of want to fold in this spot, but yeah, it's hard to fold. So
yeah, I don't know. That was interesting to me.
I would have folded it. Ace, yeah.
That's interesting to me. When you tweeted this hand, you said, oh, someday I'll be good enough to fold. And I mean, I love folding, and I love, you know, reading bet sizing and all this. I was just wondering why you don't think that you're in good shape, even against a pretty good value range. Like, Ace Jack and Ace Queen seem perfectly consistent with him thinking he has the nuts. Maybe he wouldn't bet so big on the flop with Ace Queen is what you're thinking. I can see some reasons here why you might be really scared, but especially those two hands, I think, are very possible for him, and it's really hard for him to have a set of aces or jacks, and he probably can't have a set of queens. So
he can't have a set of queens, but he could have king 10. So I think those two things sort of offset one another. You agree with me that's never a raise, obviously.
That the three sixes is never a raise?
That the river is never a check raise, yeah.
I mean, never under these game conditions. I think that in live games, I don't know. I mean, I want to give the cop-out answer where the standard play against standard low stakes regular is not to raise, but you know, I can just think of so many dozens of people against whom by the time they bet the river, you know, they just have ace queen and ace jack a lot, and they're gonna call a raise, and they're never gonna three bet me without having me beat. So like, I'm not in a bad spot if I get three bet, and the range is still pretty wide, and they hate to fold in general, and specifically they hate to fold to me. So I mean, if I were plopped down in a PokerStars Zoom game against this guy, then no, I wouldn't raise the river with three sixes. But I guess you're talking to a live player these days, and especially since I have a pretty good spidey sense for people having big hands pre-flop and even big hands on the flop, there are a lot of people against whom I could just cut out those nine combos of aces, queens, and jacks, and the 16 combos of king 10 almost completely. So I can't say it's never a raise, but I do see why it's not a default raise at these stakes in these game conditions. So there's my cop-out answer.
that's fine. I agree with all those conditionals for sure.
It's interesting, given that you made something of his flop bet size, it's interesting to me that you think that king 10 is still in his range in a significant way at the river. I think that would, I mean, both given that he bet the turn. So I would think that he would check behind the flop sometimes with king 10, not bet so much a lot of the time with king 10, and check behind the turn often with king 10. So by the time it gets to the river, you know, of course, in a vacuum, I would expect a strong bet size with the nuts, but I think it's inconsistent with other things that came before it.
No, I agree. I agree with all those points 100%, actually. So, I mean, basically, I should say, like, if we put aside, like, epistemological humility for a second, I think his range here is set of jacks, king 10 of hearts, and ace jack. And you know, pocket aces. I think that might be it. That might be the extent of his range.
Interesting. And so not ace queen.
Not ace queen because both what you said, his cutoff, his flop bet with ace queen is pretty unlikely. But I should add that his turn timing, his flop turn and river timing were all of the same beat, and that was of a player who could not control himself.
He had to put
money in, you know, and a lot of players just struggle to A, balance any timing, and B, to bet value hands with a slow timing when they're when they have the initiative, or when they continue to hold the initiative. So he bet the turn very quickly, and he bet the river very quickly in the same way that he bet the turn, in the same length of time they bet the turn. And for him to put out 1450 into, what's going to be like 1890 on the graphic interface, for him to put out a bet that big, that quickly, I mean, that, I've become skeptical whether he could even do that with ace jack, because I think he would bet less with ace jack. And I guess the other thing we've got to tell the listeners is that his river aggression frequency was 0 for 4. So he's basically, I only have 50 hands on this player, but when I see a river aggression frequency of 0 for 4, then I would honestly expect him to bet like $10 with ace jack and maybe even ace queen. So yeah, I'm really, really getting close when we add all these ingredients together to making a check fold on the river.
Good. Interesting. So we have three combinations of sets of aces, three combinations of sets of jacks, one combination of king 10 of hearts, and nine combinations of ace jack, although those nine combinations are discounted. So we have seven, and I would want to discount king 10 of hearts a little bit, maybe, but let's say that there are between six and seven combinations of those hands. Then, so the question is, how much do we have to discount the nine combinations of ace jack before it's a fold? And, you know, you're getting, you know, he's betting 3/4 of the pot, so you need to be good.
We're calling 3 to win 7, are we not?
Yes.
Three to win seven.
There we go. 3 to win 7. So yeah, you have to be good 30% of the time. So let's say he has the full seven combinations of the value hands. He needs to play ace jack like that 1/3 of the time, neglecting all other hands. Yeah, I mean, I guess I just, you know, despite loving to fold, I think I can't fold this here. If I knew my player really well, then I could fold, of course. But yeah, I like the call. I like that you felt bad about the call and skeptical that you had a chance to win. And I definitely like that you didn't raise. So nice hand.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, it's weird for me to be complimenting you, given that you know a lot more than I do about whether this play was correct. But for whatever it's worth, you know, well done.
Well, I mean, that's kind of one thing I want to try and add without injecting too much of my own ego. Like, when you play these Zoomer Rush games, like, after a while, you do get a spidey sense. So I don't know if it's, like, at a million hands, or I've played probably 2 million hands of this kind of game, and it's, yeah, like, my spidey sense was going off on by the time he put out the river bet. So it's not even clear to me that I should call. It was close enough that I thought I should tweet it. So
good. So yeah. just to make the reveal here, Villain did have three aces, and so Gareth did lose, and he felt like he should maybe fold. I want to talk a little bit more about what you just said, because, I mean, for me, the interesting, besides all the very interesting things about your story, and by the way, listeners, if you have not listened to Gareth's interview on the show, you should go back and listen to it. It's a listener favorite. But I want to talk about game selection a little bit with you. So you play Zoom, and that has some obvious benefits. You know, you get a lot of hands quickly. You're better than your competition. If you are playing in sort of on shaky South American internet connections, you lose less when you disconnect than you do if you're 20 tabling tournaments. I mean, is that a factor? Am I right or wrong there?
That's certainly a factor for why – that's one of the many factors in why I had actually a New Year's resolution of not playing any online tournaments this year, which is a pretty big – commitment for me to make. But yeah, I can't set aside a Sunday to play a full slate of MTTs at Starbucks. Yeah, so I guess that is a consideration.
Yeah, so I guess what I wanted to talk about is, you know, it obviously makes sense for you to be playing Zoom now, and you develop this great spidey sense, and you're beating the games, you're comfortable there, and that all sounds good. But we get a lot of email from listeners asking what games to play and, you know, should they switch? And I guess my question to you is, what sorts of things could happen that would convince you to switch your main game from Zoom to something else?
That's interesting. I would say the player pool is the main thing that I monitor. I mean, I think that it is generally accepted, and this is one of the cases where the conventional wisdom, or the what was Galbraith's phrase? Common conventional wisdom?
Yeah, something like that.
I feel like I need to Google it because I don't want to misquote John Kenneth Galbraith.
But, 1 second. Galbraith, conventional wisdom. Yes, conventional wisdom. That appears to be a Galbraithism. Yes. Okay.
So I think the conventional wisdom is that the non-Zoom games are softer than the Zoom games, than their Zoom equivalent, in terms of like the win rate you can achieve if you table select well. And this seems to me to be true. So the reason I don't play those games is because I actually started in cash when Rush Poker came out. Like I never played Six Max No Limit or any cash game No Limit for an appreciable volume until Rush came out. So I literally don't have very good table selecting skills. I don't have like an algorithm or a routine in which to table select. And though there was a period of time between when Full Tilt stopped operating and when PokerStars came out with Zoom, there was like that gap where I had to play regular tables. Yeah, I feel like I expended a lot of energy table selecting and not in an efficient way. So there's going to be a high learning curve in switching to non-Zoom. And, you know, I monitor the player pools. So if the player pools begin to dry up, that's something I might want to start investing time in. But the fact that I can just sit down and fire up four to six Zoom tables whenever, you know, my mood strikes me, that's a pretty big bonus to me, you know, because people who are playing heads up or who are, you know, just playing normal tables at a game where, you know, table selection's important, it seems to me that they spend a lot of time. If they're good players, if they have a high win rate, they necessarily spend a lot of good time table selecting. And yeah, it's just an undertaking that I don't necessarily want to do, take on.
No, that's good. That all makes sense. I mean, certainly when I was a heads up regular, I spent a lot of time either sitting around or playing regulars who I couldn't achieve my optimal win rate whenever I wanted at the drop of a hat. You know, I certainly think I was in a good spot against those other regulars, but I was definitely spending a lot of time waiting around for other people and getting buttoned by regulars or those slimy people who just go around buttoning people all day, and that sucked.
Yeah, like I have no, there's all these like 2+2 threads about buttoning and about rat holing and various slimy things. Like I just have no context in which to discuss those things, you know, like they've never happened to me in Zoom. You get, sorry, there's some background noise here.
It's okay. It sounds like people are playing pool.
just chairs being moved around. That's all.
I see.
So I just can't put those in any sort of meaningful context, because everyone gets an equal shot at having the fish at their table in Zoom. And this seems to me to be a very good solution to the question of, like, who gets to take the fish's money. And, yeah, it stimulates action between regulars, too, because, you know, you're forced to play all the regulars in a fairly equal distribution. There is some game selection in Zoom, though, in the sense of when to play and what days to play.
Yeah, and what stakes, I guess.
And what stakes, yeah. So I have been doing a much better job of playing Wednesday through Sunday and not playing at all on Mondays and Tuesdays. And I think when, yeah, I had a bad habit of not being able to take a day off, which I seem to have kicked. Yeah, so I've kicked that habit, and I think taking Mondays and Tuesdays off, and then just like on Sundays, just trying to put myself in a position to play an absurd number of hours, this really gives me a huge edge over like another regular from like a reciprocity perspective. If they're, yeah, if they're clocking in Mondays and Tuesdays, you know, maybe they have something to do on the weekend.
Sure.
Yeah. This is a big advantage, I think, for me.
Yeah. And so you said something earlier that was very interesting, namely that you aren't putting a lot of money in bad on the river these days. It sounds like maybe your variance is lower at these games than it might be in some other games where you had even an equal win rate. And I don't want to pry, but if some of the things we talked about in the last interview are still true, maybe you don't have a $250,000 bankroll that you're playing 50 cent Zoom poker with. So, I mean, I guess that's another benefit to you of playing Zoom, right? Like you're really in control and maybe you're keeping the swings down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, especially now, I think all those things about variance you said are true. My like online bankroll is actually quite deep now for the games I play. Sick brag. Like you know, like yeah, for 50 NL Zoom, I have approaching 200 buy-ins on stars, and I don't need to keep that much on, but I mean, the real reason that I'm still grinding like 50 NL and 100 NL, and like I don't really have short-term plans to even sit at 200 is basically the fact that I need to take out at a minimum, I guess, $1,200 a month from PokerStars. Like, right. if I don't withdraw $1,200 every month from PokerStars, like there's gonna be trouble,
right?
You know, so just in terms of the money I have behind in the real world and the expenses, my current like travel lifestyle is, you know, eating into my bankroll. So yeah, being able to not worry about that, like not worrying about hitting that $1,200 every month, like basically I haven't, yeah, it just hasn't come up as a point of stress. So I take this as a very large benefit, because yeah. I don't want to be like on the 20th of the month and be like buried for some amount of money.
Yeah.
And I just want to avoid that entirely.
Yeah. So like 40 buying downswing at 200 NL would cause you problems.
Right. Like say, so I've been winning about 6 big blinds per 100 for like an appreciable sample of my most recent hands. Like say if I cut down the number of tables I'm playing and really like Mondays and Tuesdays just looked over the regulars' habits and really focused on quality, and like I could be 2 big blind per 100 winner at the 200 NL games. Like I don't even know if that's true, because my basic assumption, like my baseline assumption regarding poker, is that I suck at poker.
Okay.
a theoretical perspective, but also for purposes of improving, I think it's, yeah, I think it's worth just assuming that you're bad. Yeah, even if I could beat the 200 NL games for like 2 big blinds per 100, it's not so clear to me that the variance wouldn't stress me out a ton.
Right.
Yeah, just in terms of like my schedule of needing to withdraw money. So
yeah, I wanted to ask you about your thought process there, and in particular about your sort of counterfactual thought processes in the case where you would think about switching games. And as that goes, you know, monitoring the player pool seems like absolutely the most important thing to keep track of. But, you know, especially because it is something that our listeners ask about a lot. You're not in a situation that a lot of our listeners are in, I think, but I think it is a good case study for helping people think through these decisions in a responsible and accurate way. So, so thanks for sharing.
Like, oh, it's no worry at all. Like you and Andrew have talked briefly on the podcast about the benefits of specializing versus diversifying your games.
Yes.
I guess one thing is that I'm just terrible at other games. Like, I'm really bad. I don't know the first thing about Raz. So it seems to me there's a really high opportunity cost to, like, picking these games up. Like, PLO, I'm particularly awful at. I play PLO sometimes, and, like, a turn comes up, and I get some creative idea, and that's nice. But it's not worth losing at, like, 12 big blinds per 100, you know, like,
yeah.
With
high variance when you need to be withdrawing $1,200 a month. Yeah, that's not.
Yeah, I mean, my specialization kind of has, like, begetted more specialization.
Yeah.
Because the better I get at 6-max, no limit, and I think there's still a ton of room for improvement in almost all areas. Yeah, I just like reviewing my sessions. There's just so many things I could be doing better. There's so many things I don't do well. And the amount of effort I invest into that is going to, I'm going to see the money a lot sooner. And in theory, like, those improvements could build on each other, you know?
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And especially because you're playing the thing that's probably not going to dry up as quickly as other games. You know, if you're crushing low stakes Raz by taking advantage of people who never fold 4th Street or whatever, like, once you start playing 30-60 Raz, like, people aren't going to have that leak as much. But if what you're getting really good at is 6-max no limit, that's a bit more, you know, that's a bit, both has more growth potential, and it's probably not going to go away in the next 6 months, which is a lot of what you care about right now. I mean, it also sounds like this is just not the time in your life when you want to be really innovating at poker and learning a lot of new things and sort of suffering these startup costs. You know, it's like you're on the road and you need to not go broke in the next year. So,
yeah, exactly. Like the cost of having to fly back to Canada and sleep on my friend Mike's couch, like, I perceive that as the enemy of all things good in this world. So, like, if that's true, then I really need to treat this seriously, you know, to take precautions. And, like, playing with a deep bankroll, like, over 100 buy-ins seems like the very least I could do.
How about we let you get back to that life of not going broke and meeting women and possibly dying because of it or something. So, but thanks so much for guest hosting this week. This has gone great. I hope the listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
Oh, I very much enjoyed it as well. So thanks for having me once again.
Be well. I'm sure we'll check in with you the other places you go, and travel safe and run well.
I will do on those counts what I can control.
Andrew will be back from the PCA and back on the podcast next week. Thanks very much to Gareth for taking the time to talk about some hands and about his life. Please send any questions to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. And, of course, thanks for listening. Finally, thanks as always to Mono Gold for the music. Until next Monday, have a great week.